This is October 20th, 2013, and for Teisho this morning, I'm going to talk about the role of imagination in ethics. This will be the first of a series of Teishos leading up to Great Jukai Ceremony. Every Thanksgiving weekend, we have our largest Jukai ceremony. Jukai means the receiving of the precepts. And every third Jukai, we call it a Great Jukai, and it's a little bit more elaborate, particularly in the presentation of the six realms of existence, which we dramatize in a visual audio way in the covered walkway. People, as they're going to the Great Jukai ceremony, pass through these six realms, each one dramatized, and land in this the Buddha realm, the Buddha hall, for the ceremony. Ethics is roughly equivalent to one of the three essentials, what are called the three essentials of Zen or Buddhism. These three are Shila, S-I-L-A, it's pronounced Shila, which means morality or discipline, conduct. Ethics is a little dry, but that whole realm of our behavior, our conduct, and to what degree it causes harm or doesn't cause harm to others. That's one of the three essentials. The other is meditation, and the third is prajna, which, depending on which type of Buddhism we're talking about, it can mean knowledge of Buddhist doctrine, or it can mean wisdom, experiential wisdom, transcendental wisdom, which is what we usually mean in Zen. So at this time of year, as Jukai is approaching, I focus more on the Shila, the morality side of Zen, which is not, we don't talk about an awful lot, because in Zen we address this true mind, this original nature of ours, out of which all moral systems arise. That is, we want to, in our Zazen, we want to get underneath all systems to this womb of morality, which is mind, mu, original nature. And yet, in our navigating through our daily lives, it can help to have some sense of moral structure, moral rules. Many of the masters, many of the great Zen masters, began their Buddhist careers in the Vinaya school. This was a big, highly respected sect of Buddhism in ancient times that involved a study and a mastery of Buddhist monastic rules and regulations. And we could say, as Yasutani Roshi did, we could say that the Shila, the morality side of the three, the morality really constitutes the foundation of practice. So these great masters, before ever getting into the meditation, they established the foundation, which from a Zen perspective, this moral foundation is itself an expression of this Buddha nature of ours. So it's not just learning rules, but learning to embody these rules that describe our truest nature. And I was on the internet recently and came upon this discussion of how imagination works in terms of moral considerations, moral reflections, and I got intrigued in it because normally in my I used to think that imagination doesn't have much of a place in Zen practice. That's if we think of imagination as fantasy. But if we think of imagination in the way we're going to discuss today, then certainly it's can be extremely helpful in this realm of morality. One article I came across is by a Mark Johnson, the University of Chicago. The article is called Moral Imagination, Implications of Cognitive Science for Ethics. Anyway, this Mark Johnson points out that using the imagination in finding one's way ethically is a new position because our moral tradition is based on absolute rules that are to be applied universally. So we have the Ten Commandments, for example. We have the Ten Cardinal Precepts, which, as we'll hear, allow for a lot more interpretation than many people seem to think the Ten Commandments do. But he says here, in the process of moral imagining, we might consult a rule or principle, but we do not merely apply that rule. Instead, we imagine what the consequences might be of following or not following the rule. So that's the basic premise. And I think it doesn't take much imagination to appreciate this point of view. He offers up the situation, for example, of a 15-year-old who is pregnant. This situation requires her to imagine the possible courses of action open to her and how they might shape her future. There are many factors that she must consider when she imaginatively projects herself into alternative scenarios. For example, what if she has an abortion? She must imagine how that would make her feel, how other people would react to her, and what problems might be resolved or created. She must also imagine what it would be like to carry the fetus to full term, to marry her partner, or to raise the child alone, to choose adoption, or to request that her family take responsibility. In her imagination, she must project herself into each situation. I think we just do this naturally. And this is, I think, is a useful way to use our imaginations in cases like this. The discussion now will resume with an article called The Ethics of Imagination. This is by a different guy. His name is Mikhail Epstein. And this is from the book Transcultural Experiments, Russian and American Models of Creative Communication. And this, as the title suggests, this here the author is considering morality and moral decisions that would suit us in transcultural situations and others than our own. And he starts off by talking about the golden rule. He says, if we look at the most common and established ethical rule, as it is inscribed in the heritage of many cultures, Christian, Chinese, and Greek, we find an implicit call for imagination as expressed in the requirement that we do unto others as we would have them do unto us. This presupposes a kind of commonness between ourselves and others that cannot be found in an actual existence and empirical experience. I have to be careful here because some of this gets pretty academic and is not that accessible for absorbing from a talk. Without imagination, a person would be unable to put herself in the position of others, or to put others in her own position. One has to be imaginative to be righteous. One has to imagine what other people may need, dream of, and aspire to in order to respond adequately to their needs. Now I'm going to take a big side trip here and look at this golden rule, so called, and how it's defective in its wording. And I'm going to go back to one of my all-time favorite books. This is called The User Illusion. It was published in 1991 originally. It's by a Norwegian editor or journalist by the name of Tor Nuretranders. Not to spend too much time on it, but it's basically a book on neuroscience and the implications of recent research in neuroscience. One of the most staggering findings that he explores over the course of like 100 pages is the fact that there's a lag between our impulse to act and our becoming conscious of it. Now, I could build this the plausibility of this as he did by reading an awful lot from neuroscience laboratories, but we don't have the time, so I'm just going to ask that people accept this as a starting point, that when we have an impulse or an urge, we're not aware of it. So there's this lag, and it's just shown through laboratory experiments that when we think we have free will in initiate an action, actually it's not conscious to us. We start initiating the action without it being conscious. Anyway, the important thing in terms of this discussion is that that although we don't have free will in terms of what we're consciously aware of, what we do have free will in is whether we allow an impulse or an urge to play out. Consciousness, in his words, consciousness cannot initiate an action, but it can decide that it should not be carried out. And this all will serve us well in understanding this golden rule more clearly. So he makes the point that many ethical strictures, such as most of the Ten Commandments, are injunctions not to act in certain ways. In other words, we can control our actions, but not our urges. And he says there's a big difference between Judaism and Christianity regarding what you may and may not do. Judaism talks in vetoes. You must not kill, steal, fornicate, etc. The Ten Commandments from the Old Testament are the moral foundations of the Jewish faith. Christianity, however, talks of disposition. It condemns the very urge to do some of what the Ten Commandments forbid. It is sinful to want to do something you must not do, even if you don't do it. So there was a rabbi, Hillel, who lived before, actually 50 years before Christ, who said, "Do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you." In other words, turning it around and putting it in the negative. Instead of do to others what you'd have them do to you, don't do to others what you would not have them do to you. And then he says this is a much clearer rule than the Christian do unto others what you would want them to do to you. So then he makes the point that a man might know quite a few women who would not like him to do unto them what he would like them to do unto him. I don't know if anyone was stuck with me on that. I think you get the spirit of it. So you see the flaw that do unto others what you would have them do unto you. Sure, I'd like a woman to have sex with me, so I'm going to have sex with her. But it's much clearer, don't do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. So morality is a question of what one may not do. Again, this means that morality is not a question of what one may feel like doing. Morality is a question of what one does. And then he says that the Sermon on the Mount introduces a mental ethic. Not only may you not lie with your neighbor's wife, you may not even feel like it. You cannot even fancy her. Christianity says that we must do the right thing and not even feel like doing anything wrong. Judaism says you may not do what is wrong. Christianity's interdiction concerns the urge to do wrong. Judaism's concerns the act of wrongdoing, the act. Christianity then adds that you must do the right thing. In the light of Libet's veto theory, the difference between Judaism and Christianity stands out very clearly. If our consciousness has no possibility of controlling the urge to act, because our consciousness isn't even informed when the urge arises, it is difficult to see how we can be responsible for our urges and dreams. The Christian precepts not to desire your neighbor's wife and not to feel like doing away with your boss imply problems if the knowledge gained by in neuroscience is correct. For our consciousness cannot control our desires. This is basic. This is fundamental stuff, folks. Our consciousness cannot control our desires. The urge arises. The impulse arises. But that doesn't mean, of course, we have to act on it. That's where Judaism and Buddhism come together. I'm going to go a little further into this because so many of us came from most all of us came from Christian and Jewish backgrounds. The story of Christianity is very much a story of sin and salvation, of people laboring with their sinful minds in an eternal struggle not to be led into temptation. And then he quotes Walter Kaufman as saying, "Christianity failed morally, not because Christians have been Christian enough, not because Christians have not been Christian enough, but because of the very nature of Christianity. Christianity has always managed to make people feel that their sinful thoughts were their own individual problem. yet a Jewish neurophysiologist, this is this Benjamin Libet, an American with Russian blood, who came up with this proof in the laboratory that we have the urge or the impulse before we become conscious of it. We have the physical action initiating before we become conscious of it. He says, yet a Jewish neurophysiologist comes along and tells us that according to his theories, it is not even possible for the conscious eye to control the urges it is presented with. Okay, stay with me here now. If the conscious eye has no possibility of controlling its urges to act, how can we condemn people who experience lust every time they see their neighbor's wife? But that is exactly what the Sermon on the Mount says we must do. This is not just a theological discussion. When we're doing Zazen, especially in Sesshin, where everything becomes so accentuated in our mind, we come across impulses of every kind, ignoble impulses, base impulses. We see thoughts and feelings that perhaps as we've been conditioned to think are bad or wrong, and then we make the inference that if we're having these thoughts and feelings, then we must be bad, and then that is, I think, a big part of the problem in people realizing their true nature is having been saddled with this idea of your thoughts and feelings reflecting about who you really are. That's not who we really are. And then he goes further. He says, conversely, Libet's findings also point the finger at the problem of Judaism, that people have the right to think and feel whatever they like about each other as long as they do not act it out. Then he says, it is not your disposition but your actions that mean something in practice. That's the essence of the ethics of Judaism. But is that true, the author asks? And what are the consequences if it is not? Judaism, he says, easily becomes a spiritual license to entertain cruel, indeed evil, feelings and hopes with respect to other human beings. As long as you do not act in a way you would preferably not be subjected to yourself, whatever you think or feel is okay. The absence of a code of mental ethics in the Jewish tradition can lead to the form of inner cruelty and evil Shakespeare portrays in The Merchant of Venice. But this is simply not true. And here's where we ascend to the level of Buddhist ethics, morality, Shila, is that it all starts with our thoughts. That's where the meditation comes in. Most famous pronouncements by the Buddha, one that I've run across more than most, is the following: thoughts manifest as word, word manifests as deed, deed develops into habit, habit hardens into character. So this is the premise of meditation, is that it is by learning to manage our minds, let's say our thoughts, that we can change. And in terms of our current discussion, raise our level of morality and not cause harm to others and to ourselves. It starts with thoughts, starts with the mind. And then he uses as an example to back up his this position that you can't just allow yourself to have, you know, cruel, evil thoughts, and that's fine. He also goes back to neurophysiology. He talks about subliminal perception and what's called priming, and that we actually know more about what other people think and feel than our consciousness does. This has, I think, become somewhat commonplace, that that we have this, we may call it intuition, where we can sense, even if people aren't acting in a harmful way, and they aren't even speaking in a harmful way, there's so much we are picking up on a non-verbal level. We can sense people's energy fields, and the longer we practice meditation, the more sensitive we become to people's energy fields. People sometimes think that as a Zen teacher I can read their thoughts or something like that. I used to think that about Roshi Kapila. It caused me quite a bit of distress. Especially when I had thoughts of murderous thoughts toward him. I can't imagine any such specific thing about reading people's thoughts. I don't read anyone's thoughts. But certainly, like a lot of other people, I can sense what's going on in a very vague kind of impressionistic sense. I can sense what's going on with people. And that's something very useful if you want to help someone. So again, he says, we actually know more about what other people think and feel than our consciousness does. We don't have to be able to articulate it in order for it to be real. And that's also part of Zen practice, is learning to trust our intuitions, our sense of things, our sense of people. So then he says, so what we think and feel about each other does matter. Even when our conscious common sense tells us that it will not harm anybody, if deep down we think they deserve to be spanked. Just a little more here. If it was only what we said and did that affected others, we could think and feel however we liked and it wouldn't matter. But this is not a realistic view of human beings. In fact, Libet's own findings are like a boomerang for Jewish moral perception. Precisely because our consciousness lags behind, it is hard to control how many of our thoughts do become actions. The problem with Judaism is that it permits an inner cruelty that the consciousness cannot really control, because it lets out more from inside than we are conscious of. For example, through body language. All right, that's enough from that book. And now back to this article by Mikhail Epstein, which he starts by citing the Christian golden rule, do unto others as we would have them do unto us, as a form of employing human imagination in sorting out ethical dilemmas, ethical decisions. The 10 cardinal precepts are more like the Old Testament commandments, is that they're in the negative. We say, resolve not to kill, but to cherish all life. Resolve not to do, and not to take what is not given, resolve not to. They're all in the negative. And this reflects reality. The most we can do is veto our urges, our impulses. And then Buddhism goes even further in insisting that the only way we can really evolve is by managing our thoughts and feelings and emotions. Managing doesn't mean suppressing, of course, but learning not to cling to them. So this in this first one, we consider others as myself, not to do unto others what they would not have us do unto us. And then the author says, but there is much more to this imaginative aspect of ethics than just identifying oneself with others. Two modifications may be added to the golden rule: to embrace those aspects of ethics that are not reducible to a commonness between myself and others. So there will be three in all. The first we just went through is based on identifying oneself with others. This is the oneness aspect. In the second, he proposes an addition. It would refer to the uniqueness of the ethical subject as distinct from the ethical object. So, do unto others as we would have them do unto us, just to stick with the Christian version right now. Do unto others as we would have them do unto us. But then he adds, but as nobody else may do unto them except for us. So this emphasizes the uniqueness of oneself into the situation. The uniqueness of the ethical subject would be crucial in cases when among the many needs of others are those to which the given subject is uniquely or exclusively qualified to respond. Since I am different from the other, the ethical relationship between us should be based on our mutual irreducibility. So in this second version of imaginative ethics, do what no other person in the same situation could do in your place. Act in such a way that your most individual abilities meet the most individual needs of the others. So he gives an example. A totalitarian politics that forced, remember this author, his ancestors were in Russia, the Soviet Union, a totalitarian politics that forced a violinist to take an axe and cut wood to provide heat during an energy shortage was ethically reprehensible, though it claimed to be truly humanistic as expressing equal concern about the needs of all people. From the standpoint of the ethics of difference, the musician should not only be allowed but encouraged to respond to those specific needs of people that he is in a unique position to answer. Reduction of individual abilities to the more general needs is what underlies the crude, politically dominated ethics of mass societies, in quotation marks. So you see there's much more flexibility here that does require some imagination. And then the third level of ethics goes beyond the first one, seeing others as myself, and it goes beyond the second one also, to see others as others. And to this third one is myself as other. This capacity to be a stranger to oneself, to go beyond one's inborn or socially constructed identity, is not just a creative possibility, but also an ethical responsibility. Judeo-Christian ethics is focused on the notion of neighbor, the nearest and closest one. But what about love of, or at least responsiveness to, the distant ones? Nietzsche attempted to introduce this imperative, love to a distant one, into ethics, but his anti-Christian stance caused him to ignore love for those nearest and actually grew into contempt toward his own, quote, neighbors. As Nietzsche's contempt toward his contemporaries, his compatriots, colleagues, co-humans, and others in proximity. It is interesting that although Soviet ethical doctrines never explicitly acknowledged Nietzsche's influence, they were based on a similar principle. The distant ones were privileged over neighbors in the value hierarchy of a typical Soviet citizen. He had to love his comrades, his class brothers, and the exploited, toiling masses all over the world, but was required to denounce his family members on the basis of their disloyalty to the state. Soviet ethics was devoid of imagination and did not recognize the right of model citizens to multiple identities or alterations of identity. In fact, love for distant ones, or at least the ability to interact with them, depends on the capacity of a given subject to be different from itself, to embrace an unlimited range of virtual or potential identities. This third level can be described as an interferential ethics. And never do we need this more than in our modern world, global, highly globalized world, where we're so in touch with what's happening all over the world with others. We do need to have to imagine on a bigger scale than just certainly ourselves or even those closest to us. And then this author gets into one more topic, which is what he calls ethics in the subjunctive. And what he means by that is being open to different interpretations. He says ethical prescriptions include the freedom from prescriptions. This certainly applies to the 10 cardinal precepts in Buddhism. When Christ said, "Know the truth, and the truth will set you free," he expressed in prescriptive form the freedom from all prescriptions. And this gets us back to this original nature of ours, to know that, to delve into this realm of no mind, and out of that understanding, out of that prajna, wisdom, to know how to find our way through this enormously, what can be enormously complex world of morality. He makes a nice point here. He says, if we look at the most elementary forms of ethics, such as politeness and courtesy, we find that even these most routine models of morality are based on the presumption of human freedom. If you need somebody to give you a glass of water, the polite way to express this need will not be an imperative or a command, but a suggestion. Would you please bring me a glass of water? Would it be possible for you to do this or that? The politeness is implied in the modality would, which transforms the action from the actual or imperative to a subjunctive mode. My need has to be transformed into somebody else's possibility or opportunity in order to be presented ethically, or in this case, politely. The imperative "do this" is applied only between parents and children, or officers and soldiers. Actually, in these days, it's not even much between parents and children. Thus marking the relation of power or authority. And then he says, if this is true on the level of elementary politeness, how much more important it must be on the level of the higher moral initiatives that are addressed to others. Even in the most fundamental and global issues of war and peace, power and freedom, authority and equality, discipline and responsibility, ethics should appeal to possibilities rather than impose necessity and constraints. Often the same person who uses the subjunctive "would you" when asking for a glass of water would use a categorical imperative demanding that humanity obey his grand ethical schemes and prescriptions. I'm thinking of one of the main two political parties in this country. Almost all our discourses and the procedures of teaching and writing are imbued with the imperative mode. Do as I do, do as I say, do as I write. All disciplines of scholarship and interpretation would benefit by incorporating these zones of politeness, potentiality, and imagination, which are not only an excess of aesthetic subjectivity, but first of all, modes of ethical responsiveness that multiply the levels of freedom in our readers, students, interlocutors, instead of forcing their minds into our own persuasions. Well, this is obviously a liberal way to understand ethics and morality, but I believe it's a higher way, a more whole, more complete way of understanding these things. He continues, ethics is the domain of requests rather than commands, the domain of imagination rather than obligation. The commandments pronounced by God cannot help but be obligatory if we identify ourselves with the people of God and recognize the hierarchy that connects Heavenly Father and earthly children. However, if ethics should be understood as a specific domain regulating the relationship between brothers and sisters, and distinct from the religious domain regulating the relationship between father and children, we should formulate the principles of this ethics in a non-commanding mode, as a system of requests and proposals appealing to the freedom of the other person. The freedom of the other person. To his maybe or maybe not. Certainly this ethics in the subjunctive mood is much more favorable to the work of the transcultural imagination than an ethics that prescribes us to obey already established laws. Well, I know I'm preaching to the choir with this, but it is an interesting way to clarify it conceptually. Now, the way that he outlines these three levels of first the golden rule, and then the second one is, do unto others and so forth, but as nobody else may do unto them except us. And what we bring to the situation, our uniqueness that we bring to the situation, that is the second one. And the third one, as being able to imagine myself as the other, you know, so for example, imagining when we addressed the problem of Iraq after we invaded it and we decided to impose our democratic system on this tribal country, we might have, not that there's anything wrong with democracy, of course, but it may have affected the speed that we forced democracy on Iraq. If we had been able to imagine more effectively, imagine their whole historical experience of tribalism. That's just an example that popped in my mind. I don't know how well that works, but especially in such a such a time of internationalism, this is something that we can use in bringing to the table, the ethical table. So to put it in Zen terms, what this is all about is the interplay of two aspects of reality, which is that of the differentiation side of things and the non-differentiation side of things. The golden rule, in either of its form, the Christian or the Jewish form, New Testament or Old Testament, emphasizes the equality of all beings. But that's just half of the truth. The other half is that we are different. Even as we are all fundamentally one, we are also different. And that's, I think, what the second and third levels proposed by this guy, what they bring into it, is the awareness of that as well. So, how to simplify all this, this levels of ethics, and then this, the sorting out of differentiation and non-differentiation, well, you all know it's Zazen, delving into what is beyond both differentiation and non-differentiation. Or, actually, to begin with, delving into the formless, the realm of non-differentiation as a balance to this understanding of the world as form or differentiation, and then out of that coming to an insight that the two are not two, ultimately. All right, time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.